radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Good morning from San Diego, California. This is the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We're in beautiful San Diego, California for the 8th Firehouse World Show. And Tom, we have some guests this morning with us, correct?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. We have very fortunate to have four different apparatus manufacturers with us today representing some of the finest wildland equipment. And with us today, we got from Rosenbauer, we have Mr. Doug Feldman. From Westmark Fire, Wayne Kindred. From Boise Mobile Equipment, Mr. Jeff Ramey. And two gentlemen from Pierce Manufacturing, Rich Demsky, who's the new products manager, and Mike Switzer, who's part of the sales team from the Pierce products. So we're going to jump right into the program here this morning. And there's probably quite a bit of difference for some of our listeners and readers of the magazine of what people's perception is of what a wildland or a brush type unit is based on your geographic area in the country. Where Mike and I hail from in New York, people say we've got a brush unit. It can be anything from a slip-on unit in the back of a pickup truck to possibly that might resemble a type unit down on Long Island. They've been noted for a number of years of having stump jumpers, which are converted military 6x6s that have some roll cage built around them and able to topple over some of the light pine trees and saplings. But the type of wildland unit that we're going to be talking about today with our esteemed panel are the types of units that you see most commonly when the wildland fire season hits out in the West, whether it's California or one of the other states, and it can be any one of a number of agencies that end up responding to these types of incidents. So we're going to jump right in there and start our first question, and this is something Mike and I have talked about for quite a while in the last couple of podcasts with respect to the economy and what impact that's had on the municipal market. And I'm just kind of curious that with the wildland market, since the purchasing authorities for these types of units is not just necessarily municipal fire departments, but also can be governmental agencies, any one of the Department of Defense installations, or out here in California, Cal Fire, or the BLM, or the U.S. Forest Service. So we have a myriad of users of these types of vehicles with different physical appearances and, not surprisingly, different colors. So we'll start out with Rich and Mike. What, from your perspective, what impact have you seen with the current economic state in our country here, and what impact that's had on your portion of the wildland marketplace?
Good morning, Mike and Tom. We appreciate you inviting us on this panel today. In respect to that particular question, we've noticed that departments recognize the wildland units as a source of income, as they quite often have the units contracted out to agencies such as Cal Fire, the United States Department of Forestry, and et cetera. They are also utilizing the Type 3s as a decent substitute for an engine in an urban environment. The newer Type 2As outfitted for 1901 compliancy makes the wildland unit more versatile. As we see less funding for custom units, the Model 34 opens up a new type of market for those folks.
Okay, maybe we'll probably just, you mentioned a few models, and for the listeners out there, let's the basic definition in a couple sentences of a Type 3 constitutes what type or what style of unit?
Basically, a Type 3 normally consists of a 500 GPM pump, somewhere between 500 and 800 gallons of water. They normally don't have an accompaniment of ladders, and they're classified as a 1906. However, we have seen some folks upgrading these units with ladders and 1901 compliancy so they can have an urban interface unit as well.
Okay, and a type, Mike, a Type 2A unit looks like what?
The Type 2A would have basically the same amount of water as your Type 3, but it would have the full complement of the 1901 ladders, additional equipment carrying capabilities on that vehicle to make it more of an urban interface vehicle.
Oh, okay, so now we've left the area of just like a purely of a wildland or brush unit, where something that does have some degree of typical triple combination pumping capabilities as well.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Wayne, what do you see in the marketplace with how the economy's impacted your portion of what your company contributes?
Again, thank you for allowing us here today. Westmark is a manufacturer of what we call a true wildland, made for wildland firefighting. And the market has taken a drastic downturn because of the economy, but there is still people that are buying the wildland because they need them for their protection in their areas. In our part of the country, we fight wildland fires that are in terrain, and those people are actually still buying vehicles today. Not as many, but our market is still there, but not nearly as strong as it was.
Okay, thanks. Mike mentioned about contracting out the apparatus, and that's kind of a unique concept. Brother Mike and I had a little bit of exposure to that a number of years ago when we were doing some training up at the Indian Reservation up in Riverside County, where they contracted out. At that point, all they had was a water tender, but they had the ability, and it wasn't anything that really looked like a fire truck, but it was one of those things. When it left the reservation, that they were like, it was almost like a cash cow. Kind of interesting concept. Jeff, with your background at Boise Mobile and the fact that you had formerly been the fire chief of the city there, did that situation ever exist to you during your tenure in the department there, where you were able to take any of your apparatus and contract it out to somebody to make money there?
Boise Fire never took advantage of it. They chose not to. We have a pretty large city there, and some impact. We had automatic aid agreements with the BLM, but we never focused on taking our resources to other areas. We just were pretty strapped for our equipment, and the city of Boise and the community wanted the protection remained in the city for the most part, and we didn't have extra firefighters or necessarily extra equipment to send out any place. We found ourselves really focusing just in our surrounding area where we had automatic aid. Several of our other departments in the valley have taken advantage of that. A lot of smaller departments, that's the way they found funding, but Boise City elected really not to do that.
Okay. When you mentioned about automatic aid, was this where your department, where like the city boundaries were and where it became BLM territory, that if there was a call within that boundary area, that both you and BLM would respond to that?
Yeah, we'd both get paged out on the initial call, and whoever got there first would take over. Most of the time, Boise Fire would be on scene up to a half hour, 45 minutes before BLM got there. And in that case, we had our complement of wildland apparatus, which really wasn't that thorough. We have Boise City has two type fours and two type sixes and a couple tenders.
Okay.
And we just Boise City elected to do type fours because that's what the BLM runs up there. We wanted to be able to play alongside them. So Boise City didn't have enough even for a strike team on their own.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Hey, Mike, it's pretty interesting thought here. Maybe what you want to do is post-retirement at some point with FDNY, you're going to take your ladder company and you can become a rent-a-truck. All right. Now, probably can't do much for wildland firefighting because you only got a can on there, but what do you think? Maybe that.
Yeah, we could be we could do really good with some elevator emergencies and some water leaks, I think, Brother Tom. We could rent ourselves out. I have a question. Being from the East Coast and having just come out here at different points in time, we've had a pretty good explanation from the Pierce reps of Type 2 and Type 3 apparatus, or 2A. And then you mentioned four and six. For us non-compliant, nondescript East Coasters, what are the rest of the types and the manning or staffing on those units, and how does that work? Can you answer that, Chief?
Now, did you say type six?
You had mentioned type six and type
right.
four. How many types are there?
Six.
Six. We go from one to six. Okay, so we've had an explanation.
Wow, even a truck guy can probably get his arms around that eventually there. That sounds like a promotional test question
yeah,
there.
Yeah, but Brother Tom, I have to use more than one hand to get up to six.
Well, okay.
It is a little tough, so... if you could give us an explanation of the other types, we've had a pretty good explanation of type 2 and type 3.
Sure.
Another shot.
We'll go. Type 6 is typically, your standard pickup looking fire truck, maybe a 550 Ford, and even some of them can be slightly bigger with the GMCs. Physically, they look bigger, but, they're carrying anywhere from 200 to 300 and maybe eking a little bit more water out of that based on GVW and other payload that you carry with it, usually some light hose, a hose reel, pretty mobile, typically four-wheel drive units. Lots of times they're just a skid put on the back of a flatbed, and those become type sixes.
See, back east, we just call them brush trucks.
Okay.
makes it a lot easier. Well, let's throw a question at out here and let one of the other folks respond up for Doug. Mike and I have had some casual contact with members of the 1901 committee over a period of time on different things that we've pretty healthily debated back and forth, and in some cases had the good fortune to write up in some of the Apparatus Architect articles. But there seems to be, I guess, no consensus, or at least maybe it's because of our lack of knowledge here. So I'm just curious what your thoughts is, given the wide range of wildland apparatus and how departments expect to utilize these things, when you get out into the municipal side of the market, does Rosenbauer feel that the current 1906 standard is adequate to meet those needs, or are there some things that you find that people are asking for that are either over and above the standard or potentially maybe at variance with the standard that you then have to sometimes hem and haw and try to slant them in the right direction, so to speak?
Right. The 1906 committee, as it stands, is a fairly complete set of guidelines, but they are looking at enhancing or expanding the 1906 guidelines, which I think has a lot of, especially the federal and state, Cal Fire, U.S. Forest Service, has them a little concerned, is that they are adding a lot of different aspects from 1901 into 1906. It's almost becoming a very similar set of guidelines. So that has some of the department's concern. One example is they're wanting 26-inch cones on a wildland rig. And on a wildland rig, as you guys know, there's very limited space, so they're almost going a little too far, in my opinion, on the 1906. They're becoming more and more like 1901. And I think the inherent risk in that is if they continue down that road, a lot of departments like Cal Fire or U.S. Forest Service or BLM will not follow the 1906 guideline and set their own standards. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think the inherent risk is they're going a little bit too far. A wildland rig, guys, there's not a lot of room on these engines for stuff like cones. That's just my view on 1906.
Okay, for Mike and Rich from Pearson, what's your perspective on that? You folks probably cover a larger geographic area in the country with your particular product mix, so you've got folks that might be very sensitive to the wildland strike team component, where everything needs to be interchangeable and there can't be a lot of differentiation. Again, for our listeners, if you've ever had the opportunity to look at these units up close and personal, so to speak, there is a great degree of commonality. Mike and I have often spoken about, you could take an engine company from FDNY and drop it into the city of Los Angeles, and they'd kind of stare at it, and other than the fact it's six tires and is some shade of red, they'd look at it and give you a blank stare, like, what are we supposed to do with this? And vice versa. The firefighting, ultimately the fire goes out, but the style of firefighting, their tactics, and how how the apparatus is set up varies quite a bit. What limited exposure I've had to looking at least at type 3 units and having some of the equipment explain to me what it is, the first time I looked in, they said it's a backfire torch. I said, what do you do with that? He goes, we set backfires. I'm like, okay, that's pretty obvious, but you normally don't do that at a structural fire. So for your folks' perspective, what areas do you see that are either pretty much in concert, or do you see some pushback from people saying, you know, we can't have, you know, be changing up the style of what we buy and what we do based on somebody's perception as to what a standard might need to be?
And you're absolutely right, Tom. We at Pierce have seen these types of units, wildland, type 3, brush trucks, type 6, whichever you wish to call them. We've actually sent these types of units all around the world. One of our largest customers, the United States Navy, has adopted the Type 3s as their West Coast-style wildland unit, and more of a conventional, what was explained as a Type 6, would be their East Coast-style unit. And those units also have gone abroad to places such as Rota, Spain, Guam, and Pearl Harbor. So in that respect, I think standardization is the key word there. We've also seen folks wanting to adapt the 1901 compliancy on these vehicles, mostly for the safety aspect. With some of the newer implementations of the 2009 NFPA, such as vehicle data recorders, seatbelt indicators, helmet holders, lighting, we've seen these things become desirable with the fire departments as far as safety and standardization.
All right. Thanks. Wayne, it was interesting that you mentioned a couple of, what your products are. And again, just from the outsider's perspective, and maybe it has to do more that I'm focusing in on the color rather than the actual equipment that these units carry. But it seems to me that if you take the U.S. Forest Service versus Cal Fire versus BLM, is that everybody seems to have their own perception over the physical size of these units and what their expectations are, even if they're classified under a certain type. So is there, in actuality, a great degree of difference over what each of these agencies procure and buy within a certain classification, or is this, am I making more of it than it really needs to be?
No, there is a definite difference, and there's a lot of what we call a Type 3 wildland has always been a Type 3 wildland, and it has integrated up to a Type 2. And once you get to a Type 2, you're actually at an interface. So you need to focus on whether you're going to actually buy a interface that will go to a wildland fire, or if you actually want a Type 3 that is manufactured to go out and fight a true wildland fire. The last Type 3 we built, it went on the tilt table 33 degrees right and left. That unit, and if you look at the terrain in California on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, the terrain lends itself for this type of vehicle. So a true wildland is made to go fight those fires, and most people that want a true wildland, they'll buy a true wildland because they're not going to fight a true wildland fire with the Type 2. They will get called to the scene, but they're in staging. They're not actually out there fighting the fire on the fire line. So there's a huge difference in the two. You mentioned earlier about making money with the unit. That has been a very true, but with the economy the way it is, that is becoming a huge issue. This year, there was agencies that didn't get the call, and some of the agencies got the call, but elected not to go because they didn't want to pay them what they were getting paid the previous year. So everything is changing, driven by the economy. So,
Very interesting, kind of a roundabout way in which the economy is impacting the way these people are providing the providing the services. I'm just also throw this one back to Doug for a moment. Within a certain let's just focus on a type 3, because I think for a moment that that's probably where a large segment of the market is. How much variation is there in terms of the physical size of the unit? It seems to me that most of these units are built on Navistar 4800s or the equivalent model in a Freightliner, probably of lesser degree, but it's like there's only one or two chassis that really lend themselves to that particular application. So if somebody says Type 3, does that automatically slant you into a certain overall vehicle GVW and a physical size? The gentleman from Pierce mentioned about a range in water tank size, and I'm taking it that all these rigs have 500 GPM hydrostatically driven pumps typically for pump and roll, and other than the physical size of the water tank, there's not a whole lot that really changes in the vehicle.
Most of them are on Navistars when you get into the Type 3s in the 500 gallons of water range. Not hydrostatically driven like you mentioned. There used to be a pretty prevalent theme on hydrostats, but you don't see that many anymore. I think what throws it into that class of vehicles is the water size. When you're talking 500 to 700 gallons, you do need to bump into the Navistars. Freightliner has an equivalent now. They didn't used to have the four-wheel drive drivetrain. They do have it now. Another thing you're seeing on the chassis size, they're getting so tall. The bodies are big also, but it's all driven by cab height. And I think that will push some Wildland people into the Ford F450s and 550s. It used to be an International or Navistar cab was not that high, and you could get almost anywhere you needed to go. And they're getting extremely tall. And with the 2010 compliance, they're going to go 3 to 4 inches higher. So I think that's going to force some departments, possibly BLM, U.S. Forest Service, into the Ford chassis.
Okay.
Just because the overall height is getting so high.
All right. I want to go back, and then we'll bounce this one to just a follow-up. So I guess I'm mistaken. Maybe hydrostatic drive is something that I've read into specifications. So what's the current technology that people use, for example? And let's pick the Navistar with a 500 GPM pump. How's the pump being driven?
They're primarily PTO driven. I mean, you see hydrostats, but not as prevalent as they were, let's say, 5 to 6 years ago.
Okay.
When Cal Fire made their shift from hydrostat to PTO driven, it kind of shifted the industry towards a PTO driven pump. They, Cal Fire, will run a PTO-driven 500,
okay,
and then also an aux pump for the pump and roll. You can pump and roll with a PTO-driven, but they like the smoothness of the aux pump. And they also like the redundancy of having two pumps on board. So if that International engine goes down, they've got that aux pump for truck protection. Not all Wildland engines have an aux pump, but they've elected to go with the aux pump for pump and roll.
Okay, right. Thanks. I read in one Wildland spec, and I'm not sure where it was, but it was an item, and it talked about a quarter-inch air line plumbed to inside of the cab. Well, what would that typically be used for? I first thought it had something to do that was just chassis air that you would use back east. We use it to fill up the tires or to pressurize a PW that had been depleted. What would something like that be used for?
I've never seen it. Excuse me.
Airline inside the cab.
Airline inside.
Typically has a nozzle on it and has to clean out the cab, blow out the cab.
Oh.
Clean up.
There you go. All right. So yeah. You think about it. Yeah, there's Wildland firefighters, are riding in the cab.
Dirty, dusty.
Right. Okay. There you go. Blowing out the cab. There's an option, Mike. We could pioneer that.
Right. And I could use that in ladder 27. It would help the boys keep the inside of the cab clean, Brother Tom.
Yeah, you guys are going to so many fires and everything there. And so between that and the water leaks, I figure you just wring out your turnout gear and it just rinses out. You had the floors pitched there. Okay. Couple of have mentioned. Doug just mentioned about the issue of the 2010 cabs, and we Mike and I are somewhat conversant over what impact that has had on the custom fire truck side of the equation. So let's go down the road when we'll let everybody weigh in on this, and we'll start with Rich and Mike. What changes do you see or are you having to deal with on a manufacturing standpoint as a result of the 2010 EPA emissions and what that's doing to the typical type of chassis that, again, you'd use on a Type 3 unit?
Well, you're mentioning cab changes. We're not really going to see many cab changes, particularly, again, we're using a Navistar chassis. When they're getting into their newer engines, they're not going the route of the SCR, so their chassis componentry is pretty much staying the same. So there isn't a real big impact to our Type 3 vehicles right now with the Navistar chassis.
Right.
We are going to start looking at Freightliners, other trucks that have SCR technology on them. You will see increased heat shields. You'll see less compartmentry on the vehicles due to the extra DPF SCR equipment that's going to be on the vehicle. There'll be restrictions on exhaust temperatures and how that exhaust gets routed. Cab changes, though, pretty minor.
Okay, but Doug had mentioned, Rich, about the Navistar cab getting 3 inches higher, and I was taking that maybe they were doing something because they're increasing the size of the radiator, causing the hood and everything to go up. Is that?
Well, Pierce has been using their mid-range cab height already.
Oh.
The cab isn't really going to raise. The engine hood front end is going to raise to house their increased cooling capacity that they're requiring.
Okay.
So larger radiator, larger cooling system is forcing them to raise their hood up also. The 70, their other heavier duty 74 to 7500, 7600 series, it will raise up to all one height now, I believe, right? It's they're going across the board with the same cab height on all their models now.
Okay, and what did you see, just as a ballpark number to throw out there, what kind of either percentage or whole dollar amount did you see that cab cost going up as a result of the 2010 engines?
Chassis costs, they'll vary between manufacturer. From the low end, maybe about $6,000, $6,200, up to upwards of $10,000 per chassis.
Okay. All right, good. All right, Doug, you want to comment any further on that?
Very similar comments. One thing that is kind of nice on the Navistars is they will not require the urea at this point, which is kind of a nice feature not to have to build into those trucks. I'm not sure about the Freightliners, but again, we're predominantly a Navistar build on our Type 3s.
Okay. One of the things that I, just talking to some departments that operated as strike teams where they either a DOD component or municipal component, they were part of a strike team, that was advantageous that when they get out on these wildland units that there was much more similarity than there were differences in terms of the cab and chassis and components and stuff, so that if you needed an engine air filter or you needed brakes or whatever, those on-scene mechanics, whoever was supporting that particular incident, they're ready to do that. It's not one day you're rolling in with a brand A rig and the next day it's brand B. And even though it may have been two different body manufacturers, again, there was much more similarity than not. Have you seen any, or maybe it's too early to tell, but does it seem like the users of the wildland units would favor an engine that didn't require the SCR, that they would be looking at and say, well, that's one more thing we got to get concerned about of having to support potentially out on a long-duration incident?
You know, I think it's too early to tell, but obviously if there's one less component in the apparatus, it's going to be an advantage. I mean, and historically, they are Navistars in all aspects, BLM, U.S. Forest Service, and CAL FIRE.
Okay. Right. Thanks. Wayne, it was brought up and mentioned a little bit that with the 2010 engines that there was going to potentially be some changes in available compartment and cabinetry, the design. Have you had to face that, or what type of changes have you seen as a result of the chassis-related issues that have impacted things with respect to, you know, body modifications and things that historically you've done?
Actually, the Navistar chassis, that's the one we use. We're able to still get our body without losing any compartment space on that same chassis. It didn't make any effect on us as of the 2010 chassis.
Okay. I'm just curious for anybody, just as round number, it doesn't need to be specific, but as compared to a normal short wheelbase triple combination pumper, on a typical Type 3, how many cubic feet of storage space is on one of those units for equipment minus things, you know, in the hose bed and so forth, but something that's behind a, you know, a cabineted door, what kind of cubic foot storage space is typically on those bodies?
You know, that varies from every manufacturer and every set of specs. Typically, you know, 100 square inches of compartment space enclosure is there. Our hose beds on our wildland will carry a full complement for type 2s. We don't have a problem using that. Our wildland has a type 2 by increasing the pump to 1,000 GPM and still get the same complement on that on a Navistar 175-inch wheelbase.
Okay, let's just run down. I'm just curious again, from the very few wildland, the type 3 specs that everyone will start out with, the folks from Pierce, what type of material on a typical type 3 is the water tank made out of?
All of our water tanks are made out of poly material, carry a lifetime warranty as well.
Okay, and then typically, because I'm assuming of with weight, the body material is typically always aluminum, or does that vary?
Our Type 3 builds are made out of galvanneal bodies with aluminum doors.
Okay. All right. Let's go down. Doug, in your case?
We're primarily poly tanks, lifetime warranty, and galvanneal bodies. We'll occasionally build an aluminum body, but galvanneal has been kind of the standard, if you will, in the wildland market.
Okay. Very, very interesting. Wayne?
Yeah, you were talking about people doing their own maintenance on their vehicles while they're out of scene. So if one of these bodies get banged up out in the field, they're pretty readily available, a welder to come out there and tack together their body, keep them in service while they're at a strike.
Yep, good point. That's interesting because you look at it, there's one big difference. I was just assuming that most of these bodies were aluminum rather than anything. The galvanneal market in the municipal market, with very few exceptions, it's very small pockets of geographic areas, is just about going away. So, Wayne, in your case, what did you
say? Our case is our water tank is stainless steel. Our body is galvanneal, and we build a unitized body that the water tank is actually a wet side, goes clear out. And that gives us the greater roll stability than most people. That's why we get a low center of gravity. Our trucks are tilted at U.S. Forest Service, and our last truck up there was tilted, like I said, at 33 degrees with a 56 center of gravity, which is, if you're there, you really don't have to tilt them. So we have the lowest center of gravity in the market by using a stainless steel tank on an integrated body. Overall height is low.
Interesting. Jeff, what about in your case? What do you see?
We use poly tanks. Pretty much 95% of our tanks are UPF tanks. Our bodies vary. We probably build, I'd say, 75-80% of the steel. And occasionally somebody requests a stainless, and we'll do that. And we have built aluminum. And we've had real good success with it. You know, I don't know that most people have the confidence in aluminum that have in a steel body, and also for field repairs like you mentioned. It's lighter. It helps you get the center of gravity down, like Wayne's talking about. I have seen some, not on wildland rigs, but at Boise City, on some aluminum bodies, I've seen some aluminum come apart and shear because it's not nearly as malleable as steel, I guess. You know, it's a lot harder. And with the lifetime that a wildland rig uses, you know, and the terrain they're going through all the time, I don't know that I would buy myself an aluminum one. I have sold them to people who requested them, I guess, to be honest.
Interesting. You mentioned something that is a good point that wasn't one of the things, but we'll just run backwards, starting with you then. On a wildland unit outside of the municipal market, if it's going into BLM or the Forest Service, and anybody can chime in on this, or Cal Fire, what is the normal life cycle for these vehicles?
I think most of our customers plan on 12 years. That seems like what the number, that kind of magic number.
They run them for 12, and then
some of the agencies base it on hours of use. You know, depending on how many hours. So a truck, and which is probably a better way to do it. I know there are neighbors, the BLM, they base it on hours, and so they'll replace a truck based on how long it's been actually in service. You know, fighting fire type thing.
Okay, Wayne, what do you see?
Well, I see as a municipal not selling to BLM. Even CAL FIRE has our units still in service at 20 years because of the economy the way it is. They can't rotate them out. And most of the districts that here in California that have Type 3s keep them. They'll stay in service.
Okay. Doug?
20 years is a good number. I mean, I think when they buy them, that's what they're looking at is a 20-year replacement cycle. CAL FIRE did get way behind, and that's why they purchased a couple hundred engines over the last few years. Because they had engines coming in to be dropped off that were 25 and 30 years old. But I think 20 years is a good number on how long that engine should last.
Rich and Mike?
We at Pierce have seen very similar to what Wayne's comments were, about 10 to 12 year period, depending on abuse, obviously. We've also seen that departments will take those vehicles out of service and also donate them or auction them off and use those monies towards purchase of new equipment. So there again, depending on abuse, really is the key factor there.
Where, if the unit were coming out of one of the governmental agencies, if it's coming out of the U.S. Forest Service or BLM to go to one of the points that was made, that they replace them at hours or CAL FIRE, I'm kind of guessing when they decide to get rid of these things, they have to be pretty well beat. But where is a potential secondary market, you know, for these units? Is it to a smaller agency that's, you know, what they would be inheriting and is better than what they're running?
What we've seen, Tom, for example, right here in Southern California, our friends at Kern County, for example, have donated their Type 3 units that have been taken out of service to folks down in Mexico, actually. So that would be an example of extended duty on that particular type of apparatus.
Okay. You mentioned Kern County. I'm just going to throw a question just quick to you folks. I had received a picture from one of the fellows that I communicate back forth with in Kern County. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they had some units where they actually rebodied units that they had, that they, I think they were originally built on commercial chassis and then rebodied them on your custom chassis.
I'm not familiar with the situation.
Okay. All right. We'll end up here on our panel here because, we're very, very happy to have the Doug Feldman from Rosenbauer, Wayne Kindred from Westmark, Jeff Ramey from Boise Mobile, and both Rich and Mike from Pierce. And we need to wrap up so these folks can get back down to the floor to prepare for the opening of the program. So we've got a nice little panel here with some of the information we've gone. So to wrap up, if a department, no matter where you're located, maybe for the benefit of some of our listeners here from the East Coast, if they're considering to buy a brush unit, and here's the scenario. These people currently just have, you know, some small little 10,000 to 14,000 GVW brush unit. It's probably overloaded, as Brother Mike and I have found that in most of the communities where we've done fleet management work, it's not hard to find an overweight unit. You just need to kind of look at it, crawl underneath, and then ask the question, have you ever had the vehicle weighed? And then that's when they give you that blank stare. You know, the blood runs out of their face, and they go, no, why? And then you say, well, we think you probably want to get all these vehicles weighed, make them aware of the NFPA 1901 and the 1912 standards. And when they go to weigh these things, lo and behold, not uncommonly, these things particularly, like most of us in life, we don't get slimmer, we get a little bit heavier, and these rigs get overweight. So if somebody wants to get out of that venue and looking at getting something a little bit bigger, anything that you would want to pass along in terms of recommendations, these people are going to go out into the marketplace and just say, okay, we're going to leave the world of the 14,000 and under GVW and a small gasoline or diesel-driven pony pump with a slip-in unit. Anything that you might want to recommend that those people investigate or look at or be wary of, maybe even more important, lest they find themselves they're buying one of these things and then find out that they've made a mistake. So we'll do this in reverse. Jeff, any thoughts or comments? And in your case, since you were a fire chief, you were on the other side of the table as well at one point. So what recommendations would you think that be worthwhile to pass on to our listeners?
I think the main thing is to try to establish what use you're going to have first, and what your predominant fire load will be, or where you plan on using, or your terrain, all that kind of stuff. You know, Boise City is considerably different than here in California.
You want to actually define the mission of the vehicle?
That'd be
that
a good
we can't
idea.
Have a pumper tanker rescue ladder wildland rig?
I've seen people try to do that. Let's put it that way. No, I think initially you need to define, you know, its use. And I think that's where a lot of the Type 3s have gone into Type 2s, into an interface more type of an apparatus, because we've built a lot of Type 1 interface, you know, on four-wheel drives, because a little town somewhere has decided they want to put everything on one truck. And, boy, they try, and sometimes it works, and sometimes they wish they had two trucks. But in that event, you know, when you're limited with funds and limited with space, my thing, from my point of view with fighting fires in Boise, is I want as much water as I can have to tote around with me. So Boise City kind of lean towards a Type 4, and typically about 800 gallons of water with an auxiliary pump on it, and, you know, whatever else you could do. But water was our primary feature that we wanted.
Okay, good. Thanks very much. Wayne, from your perspective, you got somebody sitting in front of you, and you walk into their fire station and you see what they have, and you have to like turn your head away and cover your laugh for the moment and say, okay, chief, here, you know, what the how would we lead them to make a good purchasing decision?
Well, normally the department has done a research. They think they know what they're going after. My approach is that knowing what they want and what they're asking for, and you work with them diplomatically to turn them the direction which is safest for them and more benefit for their community, because you don't know what they're actually going to use that truck for, where it's going to end up at, what scene at any given time.
Very good. Wayne, I have a lot of respect, again, for all the members of the panel for where your marketplace is. So Mike and I, we need to bring you back east and let you loose with like a 14-member apparatus committee and watch you have to dance and tell somebody the answer is no tonight. Sorry, can't have it. You know, Mike's right. We've got so many, and this is what fascinates me about the wildland market, is that it's very segmented based on what people are doing and the types and styles of units. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, if somebody said they had a rescue engine or a rescue wagon, you jump in your car and drive a couple hours to go look at it. Now everybody's got one. The class Mike and I did yesterday on ladder company operations, and the preponderance, better than almost 60% of the class, operated a Quint of some description. It's pretty tough to have a multi-purpose Type 3 to try to do everything and think that you're still going to do a good job when you get out there. So again, thank you to those folks. Doug, your thoughts on that subject?
I think one mistake departments make when they're buying a wildland is don't really look at the mounts. And you really don't see them from the outside, but the way those bodies are mounted are crucial to that truck withstanding the 15 to 20 years we talked about. And a lot of y'all have seen this. When these trucks are off-road, those bodies literally come up off the frame rail. And if they're not mounted with true wildland mounts, it will rip those bodies apart. I've seen it several times. So I think that's a common mistake that a lot of departments make. When they want a wildland, they really need to spec in true wildland mounts that allow that body to lift up off the frame rail.
Okay, very good point. You probably want to get out under a creeper and go look at these things and see how they are. These aren't the kind of things that, you know, Mike and I have seen as some examples of departments that really do utilize these units, even though in a brush fire application back east, it's not like a wildland fire out here in California, one of the other western states. But they are going to take these things off the road, and there's other rigs that we've seen. These are beautiful looking rigs that can grace the cover of any magazine, but you kind of know they ain't planning on taking these bad boys off the road anytime soon. Based on the amount of polished stainless steel and chrome that's on the unit, you know, looks great in the 4th of July parade if it goes straight and doesn't not going off the hard pavement.
I would bet half the engines you see on the floor are really not true wildland trucks from the mounting standpoint.
Okay, appreciate it. All right, and we'll wrap up here. This final question with Rich and Mike, your perspective.
I'd agree with Doug there. The if you take a close look at these type threes, they really don't have a separate pump house. They're unitized body and pump house construction. A very short pump house for the limited amount of plumbing that they really have to do up front. One thing we do advise customers is really work with the manufacturer to identify the equipment that they plan on putting on these vehicles. They are limited compartmentry. They tend to, like you say, try to pack everything in those compartments as much as they can. We always want to watch the front axle ratings. These things are a short wheelbase truck, so the front axle tends to be loaded up more than what you'd see on a conventional fire truck. So front axle ratings are always very tight. You want to keep an eye and make sure the rating is going to be sufficient for your truck. You want to make sure that you provide the NFP weight allowance for that truck along with any other special equipment that he might want to carry on it, and then also add in a margin of safety so we don't end up with an overload truck once they do.
On a Wildland unit, to that point, then what's if the customer didn't give you a list as a manufacturer, you have to allow how many pounds of equipment weight on a Type 3?
I believe it's a 1,500 pound NFPA weight allowance.
Okay, well, so there you have it with our panel. Some just great information for the our listeners, from the experts, the people that do this every day of the week. While Mike and I in previous podcasts can bazoo and go back and forth over the engine versus the truck stuff and what's more important and everything, when you get into these vehicles, they are extremely specialized and not the run-of-the-mill unit. And if you make a mistake on an engine, you can maybe punt a little bit because you've got some other ones and you replace it early. You make a mistake on something on a vehicle like this where you've only got one or two in the fleet and you're going to have to live with it for a while unless you've got a real receptive bunch of folks that are going to understand your plight and bail you out. So, Mike, any other final parting thoughts here before we let these gentlemen go for today?
Well, I just want to thank everybody on our panel. From being a back east FDNY guy, I certainly learned a lot. Each time I come out to the West Coast here, I just continue to expand my vocabulary and learn a great deal about what you folks do. So thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll wrap up here. Again, thanking everyone for the panel. This is Mike Wilburn, Tom Shanney, Apparatus Architects from San Diego, California at Firehouse World 2010, where there is no snow on the ground right momentarily. We'll catch you here, and everybody, please stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.